Teresa Rucon. Chapter 1. At the end of the Rue Guénégaud, coming from the quays, you find the arcade of the Pont Neuf, a sort of narrow, dark corridor running from the Rue Mazarine to the Rue de Seine. This arcade, at the most, is 30 paces long by 2 in breadth. It is paved with worn, loose, yellowish tiles which are never free from acrid damp. The square panes of glass forming the roof are black with filth. On fine days in the summer, when the streets are burning with heavy sun, whitish light falls from the dirty glazing overhead to drag miserably through the arcade. On nasty days in winter, on foggy mornings, the glass throws nothing but darkness on the sticky tiles, unclean and abominable gloom. To the left are obscure, low, dumpy shops whence issue puffs of air as cold as if coming from a cellar. Here are dealers in toys, cardboard boxes, second-hand books. The articles displayed in their windows are covered with dust, and owing to the prevailing darkness, can only be perceived indistinctly. The shop fronts, formed of small panes of glass, streak the goods with a peculiar greenish reflex. Beyond, behind the display in the windows, the dim interiors resemble a number of lugubrious cavities animated by fantastic forms. To the right, along the whole length of the arcade, extends a wall against which the shopkeepers opposite have stuck some small cupboards. Objects without a name, goods forgotten for 20 years, are spread out there on thin shelves painted a horrible brown color. A dealer in imitation jewelry has set up shop in one of these cupboards, and there sells 15 sou rings, delicately set out on a cushion of blue velvet at the bottom of a mahogany box. Above the glazed cupboards, ascends the roughly plastered black wall, looking as if covered with leprosy, and all seamed with defacements. The arcade of the Pont Neuf is not a place for a stroll. You take it to make a short cut, to gain a few minutes. It is traversed by busy people whose sole aim is to go quick and straight before them. You see apprentices there in their working aprons, work girls taking home their work, persons of both sexes with parcels under their arms. There are also old men who drag themselves forward in the sad gloaming that falls from the glazed roof, and bands of small children who come to the arcade on leaving school, to make a noise by stamping their feet on the tiles as they run along. Throughout the day a sharp hurried ring of footsteps resounds on the stone with irritating irregularity. Nobody speaks, nobody stays there, all hurry about their business with bent heads, stepping out rapidly, without taking a single glance at the shops. The tradesmen observe with an air of alarm the passers-by who by a miracle stop before their windows. The arcade is lit at night by 3 gas burners, enclosed in heavy square lanterns. These jets of gas, hanging from the glazed roof whereon they cast spots of fawn-colored light, shed around them circles of pale glimmer that seem at moments to disappear. The arcade now assumes the aspect of a regular cutthroat alley. Great shadows stretch along the tiles, damp puffs of air enter from the street. Anyone might take the place for a subterranean gallery indistinctly lit up by 3 funeral lamps. The tradespeople for all light are contented with the faint rays which the gas burners throw upon their windows. Inside their shops, they merely have a lamp with a shade, which they place at the corner of their counter, and the passerby can then distinguish what the depths of these holes sheltering night and the daytime contain. On this blackish line of shop fronts, the windows of a cardboard box maker are flaming, 2 schist lamps pierce the shadow with a couple of yellow flames. And, on the other side of the arcade, a candle, stuck in the middle of an argand lamp glass, casts glistening stars into the box of imitation jewelry. The dealer is dozing in her cupboard, with her hands hidden under her shawl. A few years back, opposite this dealer, stood a shop whose bottle green woodwork excreted damp by all its cracks. On the signboard, made of a long narrow plank, figured, in black letters, the word, Mercery. And on one of the panes of glass in the door was written, in red, the name of a woman, Therese Rucon. To right and left were deep showcases, lined with blue paper. During the daytime the eye could only distinguish the display of goods, in a soft, obscured light. On one side were a few linen articles, crimped tulle caps at 2 and 3 francs apiece, muslin sleeves and collars, then undervests, stockings, socks, braces. Each article had grown yellow and crumpled, and hung lamentably suspended from a wire hook. The window, from top to bottom, was filled in this manner with whitish bits of clothing, which took a lugubrious aspect in the transparent obscurity. The new caps, a brighter whiteness, formed hollow spots on the blue paper covering the shelves. And the colored socks hanging on an iron rod, contributed somber notes to the livid and vague effacement of the muslin. On the other side, in a narrower showcase, were piled up large balls of green wool, white cards of black buttons, boxes of all colors and sizes, hairnets ornamented with steel beads, spread over rounds of bluish paper, fasces of knitting needles, tapestry patterns, bobbins of ribbon, along with a heap of soiled and faded articles, which doubtless had been lying in the same place for 5 or 6 years. All the tints had turned dirty gray in this cupboard, rotting with dust and damp. In summer, towards noon, when the sun scorched the squares and streets with its tawny rays, you could distinguish, behind the caps in the other window, the pale, gray profile of a young woman. This profile issued vaguely from the darkness reigning in the shop. To a low parched forehead was attached a long, narrow, pointed nose, the pale pink lips resembled tooth and threads, and the short, nervy chin was attached to the neck by a line that was supple and fat. The body, lost in the shadow, could not be seen. The profile alone appeared in its olive whiteness, perforated by a large, wide-open, black eye, and as though crushed beneath thick dark hair. This profile remained there for hours, motionless and peaceful, between a couple of caps for women, whereon the damp iron rods had imprinted bands of rust. At night, when the lamp had been lit, you could see inside the shop, which was greater in length than depth. At one end stood a small counter, at the other, a corkscrew staircase afforded communication with the rooms on the first floor. Against the walls were showcases, cupboards, rows of green cardboard boxes. 4 chairs and a table completed the furniture. The shop looked bare and frigid. The goods were done up in parcels and put away in corners instead of lying hither and thither in a joyous display of color. As a rule, 2 women were seated behind the counter, the young woman with the grave profile, and an old lady who sat dozing with a smile on her countenance. The latter was about 60, and her fat, placid face looked white in the brightness of the lamp. A great tabby cat, crouching at a corner of the counter, watched her as she slept. Lower down, on a chair, a man of 30 sat reading or chatting in a subdued voice with the young woman. He was short, delicate, and in manner languid. With his fair hair devoid of luster, his sparse beard, his face covered with red blotches, he resembled a sickly, spoiled child arrived at manhood. Shortly before 10 o'clock, the old lady awoke. The shop was then closed, and all the family went upstairs to bed. The tabby cat followed the party purring, and rubbing its head against each bar of the banisters. The lodging above comprised 3 apartments. The staircase led to a dining room which also did duty as drawing room. In a niche on the left stood a porcelain stove, opposite, a sideboard, then chairs were arranged along the walls, and a round table occupied the center. At the further end a glazed partition concealed a dark kitchen. On each side of the dining room was a sleeping apartment. The old lady, after kissing her son and daughter-in-law, withdrew. The cat went to sleep on a chair in the kitchen. The married couple entered their room, which had a second door opening on a staircase that communicated with the arcade by an obscure narrow passage. The husband, who was always trembling with fever, went to bed, while the young woman opened the window to close the shutter blinds. She remained there a few minutes facing the great black wall, which ascends and stretches above the arcade. She cast a vague wandering look upon this wall, and, without a word, she, in her turn, went to bed in disdainful indifference. Chapter 2. Madame Racan had formerly been a mercer at Vernon. For close upon 25 years, she had kept a small shop in that town. A few years after the death of her husband, becoming subject to fits of faintness, she sold her business. Her savings added to the price of this sale placed a capital of 40,000 francs in her hand, which she invested so that it brought her in an income of 2,000 francs a year. This sum amply sufficed for her requirements. She led the life of a recluse. Ignoring the poignant joys and cares of this world, she arranged for herself a tranquil existence of peace and happiness. At an annual rental of 400 francs, she took a small house with a garden descending to the edge of the Seine. This enclosed, quiet residence vaguely recalled the cloister. It stood in the center of large fields, and was approached by a narrow path. The windows of the dwelling opened to the river and to the solitary hillocks on the opposite bank. The good lady, who had passed the half-century, shut herself up in this solitary retreat, where along with her son Camille and her niece Therese, she partook of serene joy. Although Camille was then 20, his mother continued to spoil him like a little child. She adored him because she had shielded him from death, throughout a tedious childhood of constant suffering. The boy contracted every fever, every imaginable malady, one after the other. Madame Racan struggled for 15 years against these terrible evils, which arrived in rapid succession to tear her son away from her. She vanquished them all by patience, care, and adoration. Camille, having grown up, rescued from death, had contracted a shiver from the torture of the repeated shocks he had undergone. Arrested in his growth, he remained short and delicate. His long, thin limbs moved slowly and wearily. But his mother loved him all the more on account of this weakness that arched his back. She observed his thin, pale face with triumphant tenderness when she thought of how she had brought him back to life more than 10 times over. During the brief spaces of repose that his sufferings allowed him, the child attended a commercial school at Vernon. There he learned orthography and arithmetic. His science was limited to the 4 rules, and a very superficial knowledge of grammar. Later on, he took lessons in writing and bookkeeping. Madame Racan began to tremble when advised to send her son to college. She knew he would die if separated from her, and she said the books would kill him. So Camille remained ignorant, and this ignorance seemed to increase his weakness. At 18, having nothing to do, bored to death at the delicate attention of his mother, he took a situation as clerk with a linen merchant, where he earned 60 francs a month. Being of a restless nature, idleness proved unbearable. He found greater calm and better health in this labor of a brute which kept him bent all day long over invoices, over enormous additions, each figure of which he patiently added up. At night, broken down with fatigue, without an idea in his head, he enjoyed infinite delight in the doltishness that settled on him. He had to quarrel with his mother to go with the dealer in linen. She wanted to keep him always with her, between a couple of blankets, far from the accidents of life. But the young man spoke as master. He claimed work as children claim toys, not from a feeling of duty, but by instinct, by a necessity of nature. The tenderness, the devotedness of his mother had instilled into him an egotism that was ferocious. He fancied he loved those who pitied and caressed him, but, in reality, he lived apart, within himself, loving naught but his comfort, seeking by all possible means to increase his enjoyment. When the tender affection of Madame Racan disgusted him, he plunged with delight into a stupid occupation that saved him from infusions and potions. In the evening, on his return from the office, he ran to the bank of the Seine with his cousin Therese, who was then close upon 18. One day, 16 years previously, while Madame Racan was still a mercer, her brother Captain Degens brought her a little girl in his arms. He had just arrived from Algeria. "Here is a child," said he with a smile, "and you are her aunt. The mother is dead and I don't know what to do with her. I'll give her to you." The mercer took the child, smiled at her and kissed her rosy cheeks. Although Degens remained a week at Vernon, his sister barely put a question to him concerning the little girl he had brought her. She understood vaguely that the dear little creature was born at Turin, and that her mother was a woman of the country of great beauty. The captain, an hour before his departure, handed his sister a certificate of birth in which Therese, acknowledged by him to be his child, bore his name. He rejoined his regiment, and was never seen again at Vernon, being killed a few years later in Africa. Therese grew up under the fostering care of her aunt, sleeping in the same bed as Camille. She, who had an iron constitution, received the treatment of a delicate child, partaking of the same medicine as her cousin, and kept in the warm air of the room occupied by the invalid. For hours she remained crouching over the fire, in thought, watching the flames before her, without lowering her eyelids. This obligatory life of a convalescent caused her to retire within herself. She got into the habit of talking in a low voice, of moving about noiselessly, of remaining mute and motionless on a chair with expressionless, open eyes. But, when she raised an arm, when she advanced a foot, it was easy to perceive that she possessed feline suppleness, short, potent muscles, and that unmistakable energy and passion slumbered in her soporous frame. Her cousin having fallen down one day in a fainting fit, she abruptly picked him up and carried him an effort of strength that turned her cheeks scarlet. The cloistered life she led, the debilitating regimen to which she found herself subjected, failed to weaken her thin, robust form. Only her face took a pale, and even a slightly yellowish tint, making her look almost ugly in the shade. Ever and anon she went to the window, and contemplated the opposite houses on which the sun threw sheets of gold. When Madame Racan sold her business, and withdrew to the little place beside the river, Therese experienced secret thrills of joy. Her aunt had so frequently repeated to her, "Don't make a noise, be quiet," that she kept all the impetuosity of her nature carefully concealed within her. She possessed supreme composure, and an apparent tranquility that masked terrible transports. She still fancied herself in the room of her cousin, beside a dying child, and had the softened movements, the periods of silence, the placidity, the faltering speech of an old woman. When she saw the garden, the clear river, the vast green hillocks ascending on the horizon, she felt a savage desire to run and shout. She felt her heart thumping fit to burst in her bosom, but not a muscle of her face moved, and she merely smiled when her aunt inquired whether she was pleased with her new home. Life now became more pleasant for her. She maintained her supple gait, her calm, indifferent countenance. She remained the child brought up in the bed of an invalid, but inwardly she lived a burning, passionate existence. When alone on the grass beside the water, She would lie down flat on her stomach like an animal, her black eyes wide open, her body writhing, ready to spring. And she stayed there for hours, without a thought, scorched by the sun, delighted at being able to thrust her fingers in the earth. She had the most ridiculous dreams. She looked at the roaring river in defiance, imagining that the water was about to leap on her and attack her. Then she became rigid, preparing for the defense, and angrily inquiring of herself how she could vanquish the torrent. At night, Therese, appeased and silent, stitched beside her aunt, with a countenance that seemed to be dozing in the gleam that softly glided from beneath the lampshade. Camille, buried in an armchair, thought of his additions. A word uttered in a low voice, alone disturbed, at moments, the peacefulness of this drowsy home. Madame Racan observed her children with serene benevolence. She had resolved to make them husband and wife. She continued to treat her son as if he were at death's door, and she trembled when she happened to reflect that she would one day die herself, and would leave him alone and suffering. In that contingency, she relied on Therese, saying to herself that the young girl would be a vigilant guardian beside Camille. Her niece, with her tranquil manner, and mute devotedness, inspired her with unlimited confidence. She had seen Therese at work, and wished to give her to her son as a guardian angel. This marriage was a solution to the matter, foreseen and settled in her mind. The children knew for a long time that they were one day to marry. They had grown up with this idea, which had thus become familiar and natural to them. The union was spoken of in the family as a necessary and positive thing. Madame Racan had said, "We will wait until Therese is 21. And they waited patiently, without excitement, and without a blush. Camille, whose blood had become impoverished by illness, had remained a little boy in the eyes of his cousin. He kissed her as he kissed his mother, by habit, without losing any of his egotistic tranquility. He looked upon her as an obliging comrade who helped him to amuse himself, and who, if occasion offered, prepared him an infusion. When playing with her, when he held her in his arms, it was as if he had a boy to deal with. He experienced no thrill, and at these moments the idea had never occurred to him of planting a warm kiss on her lips as she struggled with a nervous laugh to free herself. The girl also seemed to have remained cold and indifferent. At times her great eyes rested on Camille and fixedly gazed at him with sovereign calm. On such occasions her lips alone made almost imperceptible little motions. Nothing could be read on her expressionless countenance, which an inexorable will always maintain gentle and attentive. Therese became grave when the conversation turned to her marriage, contenting herself with approving all that Madame Racan said by a sign of the head. Camille went to sleep. On summer evenings, the two young people ran to the edge of the water. Camille, irritated at the incessant attentions of his mother, at times broke out in open revolt. He wished to run about and make himself ill, to escape the fondling that disgusted him. He would then drag Therese along with him, provoking her to wrestle, to roll in the grass. One day, having pushed his cousin down, the young girl bounded to her feet with all the savageness of a wild beast, and, with flaming face and bloodshot eyes, fell upon him with clenched fists. Camille in fear sank to the ground. Months and years passed by, and at length the day fixed for the marriage arrived. Madame Racan took Therese apart, spoke to her of her father and mother, and related to her the story of her birth. The young girl listened to her aunt, and when she had finished speaking, kissed her, without answering a word. At night, Therese, instead of going into her own room, which was on the left of the staircase, entered that of her cousin, which was on the right. This was all the change that occurred in her mode of life. The following day, when the young couple came downstairs, Camille had still his sickly languidness, his righteous tranquility of an egotist. Therese still maintained her gentle indifference, and her restrained expression of frightful calmness. Chapter 3. A week after the marriage, Camille distinctly told his mother that he intended quitting Vernon to reside in Paris. Madame Racan protested, she had arranged her mode of life, and would not modify it in any way. Thereupon her son had a nervous attack, and threatened to fall ill, if she did not give way to his whim. "Never have I opposed you in your plans," said he. "I married my cousin, I took all the drugs you gave me. It is only natural, now, when I have a desire of my own, that you should be of the same mind. We will move at the end of the month." Madame Racan was unable to sleep all night. The decision Camille had come to, upset her way of living, and, in despair, she sought to arrange another existence for herself and the married couple. Little by little, she recovered calm. She reflected that the young people might have children, and that her small fortune would not then suffice. It was necessary to earn money, to go into business again, to find lucrative occupation for Therese. The next day she had become accustomed to the idea of moving, and had arranged a plan for a new life. At luncheon she was quite gay. "This is what we will do," said she to her children. "I will go to Paris tomorrow. There I will look out for a small mercery business for sale, and Therese and myself will resume selling needles and cotton, which will give us something to do. You, Camille, will act as you like. You can either stroll about in the sun, or you can find some employment."
"I shall find employment," answered the young man.
The truth was that an idiotic ambition had alone impelled Camille to leave Vernon. He wished to find a post in some important administration. He blushed with delight when he fancied he saw himself in the middle of a large office, with lustering elbow sleeves, and a pen behind his ear. Therese was not consulted. She had always displayed such passive obedience that her aunt and husband no longer took the trouble to ask her opinion. She went where they went, she did what they did, without a complaint, without a reproach, without appearing even to be aware that she changed her place of residence. Madame Racan came to Paris, and went straight to the arcade of the Pont Neuf. An old maid at Vernon had sent her to one of her relatives who in this arcade kept a mercery shop which she desired to get rid of. The former mercer found the shop rather small, and rather dark, but, in passing through Paris, she had been taken aback by the noise in the streets, by the luxuriously dressed windows, and this narrow gallery, this modest shop front, recalled her former place of business which was so peaceful. She could fancy herself again in the provinces, and she drew a long breath thinking that her dear children would be happy in this out-of-the-way corner. The low price asked for the business caused her to make up her mind. The owner sold it her for 2,000 francs, and the rent of the shop and first floor was only 1,200 francs a year. Madame Racan, who had close upon 4,000 francs saved up, calculated that she could pay for the business and settle the rent for the first year, without encroaching on her fortune. The salary Camille would be receiving, and the profit on the mercery business would suffice, she thought, to meet the daily expenses, so that she need not touch the income of her funded money, which would capitalize, and go towards providing marriage portions for her grandchildren. She returned to Vernon beaming with pleasure, relating that she had found a gem, a delightful little place right in the center of Paris. Little by little, at the end of a few days, in her conversations of an evening, the damp, obscure shop in the arcade became a palace. She pictured it to herself, so far as her memory served her, as convenient, spacious, tranquil, and replete with a thousand inestimable advantages.
"Ah! My dear Therese," said she, "you will see how happy we shall be in that nook. There are three beautiful rooms upstairs. The arcade is full of people. We will make charming displays. There is no fear of our feeling dull." But she did not stop there. All her instinct of a former shopkeeper was awakened. She gave advice to Therese, beforehand, as to buying and selling, and posted her up in all the tricks of small tradespeople. At length, the family quitted the house beside the Seine, and on the evening of the same day, were installed in the arcade of the Pont Neuf. When Therese entered the shop, where in future she was to live, it seemed to her that she was descending into the clammy soil of a grave. She felt quite disheartened, and shivered with fear. She looked at the dirty, damp gallery, visited the shop, and ascending to the first floor, walked round each room. These bare apartments, without furniture, looked frightful in their solitude and dilapidation. The young woman could not make a gesture, or utter a word. She was as if frozen. Her aunt and husband having come downstairs, she seated herself on a trunk, her hands rigid, her throat full of sobs, and yet she could not cry. Madame Racan, face to face with reality, felt embarrassed, and ashamed of her dreams. She sought to defend her acquisition. She found a remedy for every fresh inconvenience that was discovered, explaining the obscurity by saying the weather was overcast, and concluded by affirming that a sweep up would suffice to set everything right.
"Bah!" answered Camille, "all this is quite suitable. Besides, we shall only come up here at night. I shall not be home before 5 or 6 o'clock. As to you two, you will be together, so you will not be dull." The young man would never have consented to inhabit such a den, had he not relied on the comfort of his office. He said to himself that he would be warm all day at his administration, and that, at night, he would go to bed early. For a whole week, the shop and lodging remained in disorder. Therese had seated herself behind the counter from the first day, and she did not move from that place. Madame Racan was astonished at this depressed attitude. She had thought that the young woman would try to adorn her habitation. That she would place flowers at the windows, and ask for new papers, curtains and carpets. When she suggested some repairs, some kind of embellishment, her niece quietly replied, "What need is there for it? We are very well as we are. There is no necessity for luxury." It was Madame Racan who had to arrange the rooms and tidy up the shop.
Therese at last lost patience at seeing the good old lady incessantly turning round and round before her eyes. She engaged a charwoman, and forced her aunt to be seated beside her. Camille remained a month without finding employment. He lived as little as possible in the shop, preferring to stroll about all day, and he found life so dreadfully dull with nothing to do, that he spoke of returning to Berlin. But he at length obtained a post in the administration of the Orleans Railway, where he earned 100 francs a month. His dream had become realized. He set out in the morning at 8 o'clock. Walking down the Rue Guénégaud, he found himself on the quays. Then, taking short steps with his hands in his pockets, he followed the Seine from the Institut to the Jardin des Plantes. This long journey, which he performed twice daily, never wearied him. He watched the water running along, and he stopped to see the rafts of wood descending the river pass by. He thought of nothing. Frequently he planted himself before Notre Dame, to contemplate the scaffolding surrounding the cathedral which was then undergoing repair. These huge pieces of timber amused him, although he failed to understand why. Then he cast a glance into the Porte aux Vins as he went past, and after that counted the cabs coming from the station. In the evening, quite stupefied, with his head full of some silly story related to his office, he crossed the Jardin des Plantes, and went to have a look at the bears, if he was not in too great a hurry. There he remained half an hour, leaning over the rails at the top of the pit, observing the animals clumsily swaying to and fro. The behavior of these huge beasts pleased him. He examined them with gaping mouth and rounded eyes, partaking of the joy of an idiot when he perceived them bestir themselves. At last he turned homewards, dragging his feet along, busying himself with the passers-by, with the vehicles, and the shops. As soon as he arrived he dined, and then began reading. He had purchased the works of Buffon, and, every evening, he set himself to peruse 20 to 30 pages, notwithstanding the wearisome nature of the task. He also read in serial, at 10 centimes the number, the history of the Consulate and Empire by Thiers, and the history of the Girondins by Lamartine, as well as some popular scientific works. He fancied he was laboring at his education. At times, he forced his wife to listen to certain pages, to particular anecdotes, and felt very much astonished that Therese could remain pensive and silent the whole evening, without being tempted to take up a book. And he thought to himself that his wife must be a woman of very poor intelligence. Therese thrust books away from her with impatience. She preferred to remain idle, with her eyes fixed, and her thoughts wandering and lost. But she maintained an even, easy temper, exercising all her will to render herself a passive instrument, replete with supreme complacence and abnegation. The shop did not do much business. The profit was the same regularly each month. The customers consisted of female workpeople living in the neighborhood. Every 5 minutes a young girl came in to purchase a few sous worth of goods. Therese served the people with words that were ever the same, with a smile that appeared mechanically on her lips. Madame Racan displayed a more unbending, a more gossipy disposition, and, to tell the truth, it was she who attracted and retained the customers. For 3 years, days followed days and resembled one another. Camille did not once absent himself from his office. His mother and wife hardly ever left the shop. Therese, residing in damp obscurity, in gloomy, crushing silence, saw life expand before her in all its nakedness, each night bringing the same cold couch, and each morn the same empty day. Chapter 4. One day out of seven, on the Thursday evening, the Racan family received their friends. They lit a large lamp in the dining room, and put water on the fire to make tea. There was quite a set out. This particular evening emerged in bold relief from the others. It had become one of the customs of the family, who regarded it in the light of a middle-class orgy full of giddy gaiety. They did not retire to rest until 11 o'clock at night. At Paris, Madame Racan had found one of her old friends, the commissary of police Michaud, who had held a post at Vernon for 20 years, lodging in the same house as the mercer. A narrow intimacy had thus been established between them. Then, when the widow had sold her business to go and reside in the house beside the river, they had little by little lost sight of one another. Michaud left the provinces a few months later, and came to live peacefully in Paris, Rue de Seine, on his pension of 1,500 francs. One rainy day, he met his old friend in the arcade of the Pont Neuf, and the same evening dined with the family. The Thursday receptions began in this way. The former commissary of police got into the habit of calling on the Racans regularly once a week. After a while he came accompanied by his son Olivier, a great fellow of 30, dry and thin, who had married a very little woman, slow and sickly. This Olivier held the post of head clerk in the section of order and security at the prefecture of police, worth 3,000 francs a year, which made Camille feel particularly jealous. From the first day he made his appearance, Therese detested this cold, rigid individual, who imagined he honored the shop and the arcade by making a display of his great shriveled-up frame, and the exhausted condition of his poor little wife. Camille introduced another guest, an old clerk at the Orleans Railway, named Grivet, who had been 20 years in the service of the company, where he now held the position of head clerk, and earned 2,100 francs a year. It was he who gave out the work in the office where Camille had found employment, and the latter showed him certain respect. Camille, in his daydreams, had said to himself that Grivet would one day die, and that he would perhaps take his place at the end of a decade or so. Grivet was delighted at the welcome Madame Racan gave him, and he returned every week with perfect regularity. 6 months later, his Thursday visit had become, in his way of thinking, a duty. He went to the arcade of the Pont Neuf, just as he went every morning to his office, that is to say mechanically, and with the instinct of a brute. From this moment, the gatherings became charming. At 7 o'clock Madame Racan lit the fire, set the lamp in the center of the table, placed a box of dominoes beside it, and wiped the tea service which was in the sideboard. Precisely at 8 o'clock old Michaud and Grivet met before the shop, one coming from the Rue de Seine, and the other from the Rue Mazarine. As soon as they entered, all the family went up to the first floor. There, in the dining room, they seated themselves round the table waiting for Olivier Michaud and his wife who always arrived late. When the party was complete, Madame Racan poured out the tea. Camille emptied the box of dominoes on the oilcloth table cover, and everyone became deeply interested in their hands. Henceforth nothing could be heard but the jingle of dominoes. At the end of each game, the players quarreled for 2 or 3 minutes, then mournful silence was resumed, broken by the sharp clanks of the dominoes. Therese played with an indifference that irritated Camille. She took Francois, the great tabby cat that Madame Racan had brought from Vernon, on her lap, caressing it with one hand, whilst she placed her dominoes with the other. These Thursday evenings were a torture to her. Frequently she complained of being unwell, of a bad headache, so as not to play, and remain there doing nothing, and half asleep. An elbow on the table, her cheek resting on the palm of her hand, she watched the guests of her aunt and husband through a sort of yellow, smoky mist coming from the lamp. All these faces exasperated her. She looked from one to the other in profound disgust and secret irritation. Old Michaud exhibited a pasty countenance, spotted with red blotches, one of those death-like faces of an old man fallen into second childhood. Grivet had the narrow visage, the round eyes, the thin lips of an idiot. Olivier, whose bones were piercing his cheeks, gravely carried a stiff, insignificant head on a ridiculous body. As to Suzanne, the wife of Olivier, she was quite pale, with expressionless eyes, white lips, and a soft face. And Therese could not find one human being, not one living being among these grotesque and sinister creatures, with whom she was shut up. Sometimes she had hallucinations, she imagined herself buried at the bottom of a tomb, in company with mechanical corpses, who, when the strings were pulled, moved their heads, and agitated their legs and arms. The thick atmosphere of the dining room stifled her, the shivering silence, the yellow gleams of the lamp penetrated her with vague terror, and inexpressible anguish. Below, to the door of the shop, they had fixed a bell whose sharp tinkle announced the entrance of customers. Therese had her ear on the alert, and when the bell rang, she rapidly ran downstairs quite relieved, delighted at being able to quit the dining room. She slowly served the purchaser, and when she found herself alone, she sat down behind the counter where she remained as long as possible, dreading going upstairs again, and in the enjoyment of real pleasure at no longer having Grivet and Olivier before her eyes. The damp air of the shop calmed the burning fever of her hands, and she again fell into the customary grave reverie. But she could not remain like this for long. Camille became angry at her absence. He failed to comprehend how anyone could prefer the shop to the dining room on a Thursday evening, and he leaned over the banister, to look for his wife. "What's the matter?" he would shout. "What are you doing there? Why don't you come up? Grivet has the devil's own luck. He has just won again." The young woman rose painfully, and ascending to the dining room resumed her seat opposite old Michaud, whose pendant lips gave heartrending smiles. And, until 11 o'clock, she remained oppressed in her chair, watching Francois whom she held in her arms, so as to avoid seeing the cardboard dolls grimacing round her. Chapter 5. One Thursday, Camille, on returning from his office, brought with him a great fellow with square shoulders, whom he pushed in a familiar manner into the shop. "Mother," he said to Madame Racan, pointing to the newcomer, "do you recognize this gentleman?" The old mercer looked at the strapping blade, seeking among her recollections and finding nothing, while Therese placidly observed the scene. "What?" resumed Camille, "you don't recognize Laurent, little Laurent, the son of Daddy Laran who owns those beautiful fields of corn out Jefosway. Don't you remember? I went to school with him, he came to fetch me of a morning on leaving the house of his uncle, who was our neighbor, and you used to give him slices of bread and jam. All at once Madame Racan recollected little Laran, whom she found very much grown. It was quite 10 years since she had seen him. She now did her best to make him forget her lapse of memory in greeting him, by recalling a thousand little incidents of the past, and by adopting a wheedling manner towards him that was quite maternal. Laran had seated himself. With a peaceful smile on his lips, he replied to the questions addressed to him in a clear voice, casting calm and easy glances around him. "Just imagine," said Camille, "this joker has been employed at the Orleans railway station for 18 months, and it was only tonight that we met and recognized one another. The administration is so vast, so important." As the young man made this remark, he opened his eyes wider, and pinched his lips, proud to be a humble wheel in such a large machine. Shaking his head, he continued, "Oh! But he is in a good position. He has studied. He already earns 1,500 francs a year. His father sent him to college. He had read for the bar, and learned painting. That is so, is it not, Laran? You'll dine with us?"
"I am quite willing," boldly replied the other.
He got rid of his hat and made himself comfortable in the shop, while Madame Racan ran off to her stewpots. Therese, who had not yet pronounced a word, looked at the new arrival. She had never seen such a man before. Laran, who was tall and robust, with a florid complexion, astonished her. It was with a feeling akin to admiration that she contemplated his low forehead planted with coarse black hair, his full cheeks, his red lips, his regular features of sanguineous beauty. For an instant her eyes rested on his neck, a neck that was thick and short, fat and powerful. Then she became lost in the contemplation of his great hands which he kept spread out on his knees. The fingers were square, the clenched fist must be enormous and would fell an ox. Laran was a real son of a peasant, rather heavy in gait, with an arched back, with movements that were slow and precise, and an obstinate tranquil manner. One felt that his apparel concealed round and well-developed muscles, and a body of thick hard flesh. Therese examined him with curiosity, glancing from his fists to his face, and experienced little shivers when her eyes fell on his bull-like neck. Camille spread out his Buffon volumes, and his serials at 10 centimes the number, to show his friend that he also studied. Then, as if answering an inquiry he had been making of himself for some minutes, he said to Laran, "But, surely you must know my wife? Don't you remember that little cousin who used to play with us at Vernon?"
"I had no difficulty in recognizing Madame," answered Laran, looking Therese full in the face. This penetrating glance troubled the young woman, who, nevertheless, gave a forced smile, and after exchanging a few words with Laran and her husband, hurried away to join her aunt, feeling ill at ease. As soon as they had seated themselves at table, and commenced the soup, Camille thought it right to be attentive to his friend.
"How is your father?" he inquired.
"Well, I don't know," answered Laran. "We are not on good terms, we ceased corresponding 5 years ago."
"Bah!" exclaimed the clerk, astonished at such a monstrosity.
"Yes," continued the other, "the dear man has ideas of his own. As he is always at law with his neighbors, he sent me to college, in the fond hope that later on, he would find in me an advocate who would win him all his actions.
Oh! Daddy Laran has naught but useful ambitions, he even wants to get something out of his follies."
"And you wouldn't be an advocate?" inquired Camille, more and more astonished.
"Faith, no," answered his friend with a smile. "For a couple of years I pretended to follow the classes, so as to draw the allowance of 1,200 francs which my father made me. I lived with one of my college chums, who was a painter, and I set about painting also. It amused me. The calling is droll, and not at all fatiguing. We smoked and joked all the livelong day." The Racan family opened their eyes in amazement.
"Unfortunately," continued Laran, "this could not last. My father found out that I was telling him falsehoods. He stopped my 100 francs a month, and invited me to return and plow the land with him. I then tried to paint pictures on religious subjects which proved bad business. As I could plainly see that I was going to die of hunger, I sent art to the deuce and sought employment. My father will die one of these days, and I am waiting for that event to live and do nothing."
Laran spoke in a tranquil tone. In a few words he had just related a characteristic tale that depicted him at full length. In reality he was an idle fellow, with the appetite of a full-blooded man for everything, and very pronounced ideas as to easy and lasting employment. The only ambition of this great powerful frame was to do nothing,
to grovel in idleness and satiation from hour to hour. He wanted to eat well, sleep well, to abundantly satisfy his passions, without moving from his place, without running the risk of the slightest fatigue. The profession of advocate had terrified him, and he shuddered at the idea of tilling the soil. He had plunged into art, hoping to find therein a calling suitable to an idle man. The paintbrush struck him as being an instrument light to handle, and he fancied success easy. His dream was a life of cheap sensuality, a beautiful existence full of houris, of repose on divans, of victuals and intoxication. The dream lasted so long as Daddy Laurent sent the crown pieces. But when the young man, who was already 30, perceived the wolf at the door, he began to reflect. Face to face with privations, he felt himself a coward. He would not have accepted a day without bread, for the utmost glory art could bestow. As he had said himself, he sent art to the deuce, as soon as he recognized that it would never suffice to satisfy his numerous requirements. His first efforts had been below mediocrity, his peasant eyes caught a clumsy, slovenly view of nature, his muddy, badly drawn, grimacing pictures, defied all criticism. But he did not seem to have an overdose of vanity for an artist, he was not in dire despair when he had to put aside his brushes. All he really regretted was the vast studio of his college chum, where he had been voluptuously groveling for 4 or 5 years. He also regretted the women who came to pose there. Nevertheless, he found himself at ease in his position as clerk. He lived very well in a brutish fashion, and he was fond of this daily task, which did not fatigue him, and soothed his mind. Still, one thing irritated him: the food at the 18 sous ordinaries failed to appease the gluttonous appetite of his stomach. As Camille listened to his friend, he contemplated him with all the astonishment of a simpleton. This feeble man was dreaming, in a childish manner, of this studio life which his friend had been alluding to, and he questioned Laurent on the subject. "So," said he, "there were lady models who posed before you in the nude?" "Oh, yes," answered Laurent with a smile, and looking at Therese, who had turned deadly pale. "You must have thought that very funny," continued Camille, laughing like a child. "It would have made me feel most awkward. I expect you were quite scandalized the first time it happened." Laurent had spread out one of his great hands and was attentively looking at the palm. His fingers gave slight twitches, and his cheeks became flushed. "The first time," he answered, as if speaking to himself, "I fancy I thought it quite natural. This devilish art is exceedingly amusing, only it does not bring in a sou. I had a red-haired girl as model who was superb, firm white flesh, gorgeous bust, hips as wide as—" Laurent, raising his head, saw Therese mute and motionless opposite, gazing at him with ardent fixedness. Her dull black eyes seemed like two fathomless holes, and through her parted lips could be perceived the rosy tint of the inside of her mouth. She seemed as if overpowered by what she heard, and lost in thought. She continued listening. Laurent looked from Therese to Camille, and the former painter restrained a smile. He completed his phrase by a broad voluptuous gesture, which the young woman followed with her eyes. They were at dessert, and Madame Racan had just run downstairs to serve a customer. When the cloth was removed, Laurent, who for some minutes had been thoughtful, turned to Camille. "You know," he blurted out, "I must paint your portrait." This idea delighted Madame Racan and her son, but Therese remained silent. "It is summertime," resumed Laurent, "and as we leave the office at 4 o'clock, I can come here, and let you give me a sitting for a couple of hours in the evening. The picture will be finished in a week." "That will be fine," answered Camille, flushed with joy. "You shall dine with us. I will have my hair curled, and put on my black frock coat." 8 o'clock struck. Grivet and Michaud made their entry. Olivier and Suzanne arrived behind them. When Camille introduced his friend to the company, Grivet pinched his lips. He detested Laurent, whose salary, according to his idea, had risen far too rapidly. Besides, the introduction of a newcomer was quite an important matter, and the guests of the Roquins could not receive an individual unknown to them, without some display of coldness. Laurent behaved very amicably. He grasped the situation, and did his best to please the company, so as to make himself acceptable to them at once. He related anecdotes, enlivened the party by his merry laughter, and even won the friendship of Grivet. That evening Therese made no attempt to go down to the shop. She remained seated on her chair until 11 o'clock, playing and talking, avoiding the eyes of Laurent, who for that matter did not trouble himself about her. The sanguineous temperament of this strapping fellow, his full voice and jovial laughter, troubled the young woman and threw her into a sort of nervous anguish. Chapter 6. Henceforth, Laurent called almost every evening on the Roquins. He lived in the Rue Saint-Victor, opposite the Port aux Vins, where he rented a small furnished room at 18 francs a month. This attic, pierced at the top by a lift-up window, measured barely 9 square yards, and Laurent was in the habit of going home as late as possible at night. Previous to his meeting with Camille, the state of his purse not permitting him to idle away his time in the cafes, he loitered at the cheap eating houses where he took his dinner, smoking his pipe and sipping his coffee and brandy which cost him 3 sous. Then he slowly gained the Rue Saint-Victor, sauntering along the quays, where he seated himself on the benches, in mild weather. The shop in the arcade of the Pont Neuf became a charming retreat, warm and quiet, where he found amicable conversation and attention. He saved the 3 sous his coffee and brandy cost him, and gluttonously swallowed the excellent tea prepared by Madame Rocon. He remained there until 10 o'clock, dozing and digesting as if he were at home, and before taking his departure, assisted Camille to put up the shutters and close the shop for the night. One evening, he came with his easel and box of colors. He was to commence the portrait of Camille on the morrow. A canvas was purchased, minute preparations made, and the artist at last took the work in hand in the room occupied by the married couple, where Laurent said the light was the best. He took 3 evenings to draw the head. He carefully trailed the charcoal over the canvas with short, sorry strokes, his rigid, cold drawing recalling in a grotesque fashion that of the primitive masters. He copied the face of Camille with a hesitating hand, as a pupil copies an academical figure, with the clumsy exactitude that conveyed a scowl to the face. On the 4th day, he placed tiny little dabs of color on his palette, and commenced painting with the point of the brush. He then dotted the canvas with small dirty spots, and made short strokes altogether as if he had been using a pencil. At the end of each sitting, Madame Rocon and Camille were in ecstasies. But Laurent said they must wait, that the resemblance would soon come. Since the portrait had been commenced, Therese no longer quitted the room, which had been transformed into a studio. Leaving her aunt alone behind the counter, she ran upstairs at the least pretext, and forgot herself watching Laurent paint. Still grave and oppressed, paler and more silent, she sat down and observed the labor of the brushes. But this sight did not seem to amuse her very much. She came to the spot, as though attracted by some power, and she remained, as if riveted in air. Laurent at times turned round, with a smile, inquiring whether the portrait pleased her. But she barely answered, a shiver ran through her frame, and she resumed her meditative trance. Laurent, returning at night to the Rue Saint-Victor, reasoned with himself at length, discussing in his mind, whether he should become the lover of Therese, or not. "Here is a little woman," said he to himself, "who will be my sweetheart whenever I choose. She is always there, behind my back, examining, measuring me, summing me up. She trembles. She has a strange face that is mute and yet impassioned. What a miserable creature that Camille is, to be sure." And Laurent inwardly laughed as he thought of his pale, thin friend. Then he resumed. "She is bored to death in that shop. I go there, because I have nowhere else to go to, otherwise they would not often catch me in the arcade of the Pont Neuf. It is damp and sad. A woman must be wearied to death there. I please her, I am sure of it, then, why not me rather than another?" He stopped. Self-conceit was getting the better of him. Absorbed in thought, he watched the Seine running by. "Anyhow, come what may," he exclaimed, "I shall kiss her at the first opportunity. I bet she falls at once into my arms." As he resumed his walk, he was seized with indecision. "But she is ugly," thought he. "She has a long nose, and a big mouth. Besides, I have not the least love for her. I shall perhaps get myself into trouble. The matter requires reflection." Laurent, who was very prudent, turned these thoughts over in his head for a whole week. He calculated all the possible inconveniences of an intrigue with Therese, and only decided to attempt the adventure, when he felt convinced that it could be attended by no evil consequences. Therese would have every interest to conceal their intimacy, and he could get rid of her whenever he pleased. Even admitting that Camille discovered everything, and got angry, he would knock him down, if he became spiteful. From every point of view, that matter appeared to Laurent easy and engaging. Henceforth he enjoyed gentle quietude, waiting for the hour to strike. He had made up his mind to act boldly at the first opportunity. In the future he saw comfortable evenings, with all the Rocons contributing to his enjoyment, Therese giving him her love, Madame Rocon wheedling him like a mother, and Camille chatting with him so that he might not feel too dull, at night, in the shop. The portrait was almost completed, but the opportunity he desired did not occur. Therese, depressed and anxious, continued to remain in the room. But so did Camille, and Laurent was in despair at being unable to get rid of him. Nevertheless, the time came when he found himself obliged to mention that the portrait would be finished on the morrow, and Madame Racan thereupon announced that they would celebrate the completion of the work of the artist by dining together. The next day, when Laurent had given the canvas the last touch, all the family assembled to go into raptures over the striking resemblance. The portrait was vile, a dirty gray color with large violescent patches. Laurent could not use even the brightest colors, without making them dull and muddy. In spite of himself, he had exaggerated the wan complexion of his model, and the countenance of Camille resembled the greenish visage of a person who had met death by drowning. The grimacing drawing threw the features into convulsions, thus rendering the sinister resemblance all the more striking. But Camille was delighted. He declared that he had the appearance of a person of distinction on the canvas. When he had thoroughly admired his own face, he declared he would go and fetch a couple of bottles of champagne. Madame Racan went down to the shop, and the artist was alone with Thérèse. The young woman had remained seated, gazing vaguely in front of her. Laurent hesitated. He examined the portrait, and played with his brushes. There was not much time to lose. Camille might come back, and the opportunity would perhaps not occur again. The painter abruptly turned round, and found himself face to face with Thérèse. They contemplated one another for a few seconds. Then, with a violent movement, Laurent bent down, and pressed the young woman to him. Throwing back her head, he crushed her mouth beneath his lips. She made a savage, angry effort at revolt, and, then all at once gave in. They exchanged not a word. The act was silent and brutal. Chapter 7. The two sweethearts from the commencement found their intrigue necessary, inevitable and quite natural. At their first interview they conversed familiarly, kissing one another without embarrassment, and without a blush, as if their intimacy had dated back several years. They lived quite at ease in their new situation, with a tranquility and an independence that were perfect. They made their appointments. Thérèse being unable to go out, it was arranged that Laurent should come to see her. In a clear, firm voice the young woman explained to him the plan she had conceived. The interview would take place in the nuptial chamber. The sweetheart would pass by the passage which ran into the arcade, and Thérèse would open the door on the staircase to him. During this time, Camille would be at his office, and Madame Racan below, in the shop. This was a daring arrangement that ought to succeed. Laurent accepted. There was a sort of brutal temerity in his prudence, the temerity of a man with big fists. Choosing a pretext, he obtained permission from his chief to absent himself for a couple of hours, and hastened to the arcade of the Pont Neuf. The dealer in imitation jewelry was seated just opposite the door of the passage, and he had to wait until she was busy, until some young work girl came to purchase a ring or a brooch made of brass. Then, rapidly entering the passage, he ascended the narrow, dark staircase, leaning against the walls which were clammy with damp. He stumbled against the stone steps, and each time he did so, he felt a red-hot iron piercing his chest. A door opened, and on the threshold, in the midst of a gleam of white light, he perceived Thérèse, who, closing the door after him, threw her arms about his neck. Laurent was astonished to find his sweetheart handsome. He had never seen her before as she appeared to him then. Thérèse, supple and strong, pressed him in her arms, flinging her head backward, while on her visage coursed ardent rays of light and passionate smiles. This face seemed as if transfigured, with its moist lips and sparkling eyes. It now had a fond caressing look. It radiated. She was beautiful with the strong beauty born of passionate abandon. When Laurent parted from her, after his initial visit, he staggered like a drunken man, and the next day, on recovering his cunning prudent calm, he asked himself whether he should return to this young woman whose kisses gave him the fever. First of all, he positively decided to keep to himself. Then he had a cowardly feeling. He sought to forget, to avoid seeing Thérèse, and yet she always seemed to be there, implacably extending her arms. The physical suffering that this spectacle caused him became intolerable. He gave way. He arranged another meeting, and returned to the arcade of the Pont Neuf. From that day forth, Thérèse entered into his life. He did not yet accept her, although he bore with her. He had his hours of terror, his moments of prudence, and, altogether, this intrigue caused him disagreeable agitation. But his discomfort and his fears disappeared. The meetings continued and multiplied. Thérèse experienced no hesitation. She went straight where her passion urged her to go. This woman whom circumstances had bowed down, and who had at length drawn herself up erect, now revealed all her being and explained her life. Oh! If you